Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is Marcus from Gen Con TV, and we are back with a new episode of Fireside with Peter Adkisson, where the founder of Wizards of the Coast himself takes us on a trip through the untold history of Dungeons & Dragons with special guests from the game's illustrious past. In today's episode, Peter is joined by author Bruce Cordell. So without further ado, we'll drop you right into the conversation.
And our guest today will have some great stories, I'm sure. I know because I was there for some of them. We worked together back in the glory days, third edition Wizards era. So I'm really excited to have on our show today, Bruce Cordell. Thank you for joining us, Bruce.
Peter, thank you so much for having me. I've been hearing a lot about this show and I was really happy that you asked me to be on it so we can talk about some of the old times we used to have.
I know, wax lyrical about the glory days. Yes, unabashedly.
Uh-oh.
unashamedly talking of reminiscing. Yes. Well, it was a great time. But this hour today is all going to be about you, Bruce. I'd like to, while we're going to get to the meat of it, is going to be that time at TSR. Oh, by the way, don't you love how this does in my hands? I got this whole virtual background. And I was told not to, no fast motions, but I can't resist.
It looks a little like the webbed hands are like you're from Dunwich, right? And you're slowly turning back into a fish person.
I know. Got to be some fun stuff we can do with this, so. But before we get to your gaming career with D&D and so on, let's get everybody to know a little bit about you and your background. Like where were you born and raised? Where do you come from, Bruce?
You know, I was born and raised in South Dakota, town of 20,000 people. I actually lived out in the country, and so I lived near my one set of grandparents who had a farm and another set of grandparents who had a farm. So, and we also raised calves and stuff. So it was a very sort of interesting growing up.
So but, was it a cattle farm or did you have fields and tractors and stuff?
My grandparents had fields and tractors. It was a cattle farm. Yeah. And my other grandparents had a milk farm. So there was lots of cows, sheep, chickens.
We have a similar. I was raised in Idaho on a farm. My grandparents farmed wheat, barley, and peas, and they raised cattle and horses.
Oh wow! Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Didn't know that actually.
Yeah. No. And now this part of South Dakota, what is it? I'm picturing. You know, you say that part of the country, you think cornfields. Is that?
Yeah, it was the east side, so not near Black Hills or anything. It was more the Laura Ingalls Wilder area, just prairie. And, we had grown up shelter belts, which were like lines of trees here and there to try and break up the blizzards that would come in, or hold down the dirt during the Dust Bowl. But
so yeah. do you think that living in a rural environment, I always sort of hypothesized that living in a rural environment was really an incubator for role-playing in a lot of ways. I mean, like, we played role-playing games because there was nothing else to do.
I think that there's certainly something to that, right? I started playing role-playing games in Boy Scouts. I just would see, I saw the older scouts, sitting around a campfire at the picnic table and ogres, and they're using those dungeon geomorphs, and I was just fascinated. So soon enough, I got my level of scouts playing with us, and I don't know. Yeah, I guess so. There wasn't really much else to do. And I always thought that the wide open place of South Dakota, the sky gave you room to think sort of, because there was nothing else really to gather your attention.
Right. Yeah. The big open skies. Yeah. Nice. So you were playing RPGs throughout your childhood or like from a young age?
Yeah. From the time I was probably 11-ish, 11, 12, I was playing, with my Boy Scout troop. And then when I got to junior high, probably eighth grade, I was in shop class and they were having me make a little, a coaster out of leather. Right. And I happened to put a cross sword and a crossed, sword and an axe, right. You know, classic sort of D&D type thing.
Right.
And a kid came up behind me and said, "Do you play D&D?" And that kid was who been a friend ever since. His name was Monty Cook. And in fact, I now work for the company that he owns. So we've been friends for a while.
You know Monty for a long time. Yeah, I had a similar, when I was in high school, one of my dearest friends who passed away a number of years ago, CJ, you might have met him at Wizards.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yes, CJ. And we became friends because in high school, he sat behind me in Pascal, a computer programming class. And I was working on stats for Elder Dragons, you know, like sitting there in school, you know, hiding. And he's like, he was just at the right angle to look diagonally from over my right shoulder. He's like, is that Dungeons and Dragons stuff? Yeah, you play? Yeah, I play. Oh, I just got, you know, he just come into town. And so, yeah, I mean, it was so easy to just be instant friends. You know, I think within one or two nights, he was over at my place playing D&D and we're friends ever since. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. So did you go to school to study Dungeons and Dragons, or
I went off to Colorado actually to study biotechnology. I wanted to be a genetic engineer to slow the aging process, and I ended up getting a degree in biology and working in the biopharmaceutical company for a few years. So no D&D.
You really got off track there, Bruce. I gotta say.
Well,
I mean, we all know this story has a happy ending.
I've fallen onto a parallel universe. What's happening here? So, yeah, during that time when I was working, my friend Monty had gone. He graduated college pretty quickly. It took me like 6 years to get through, and he got a job working at Iron Crown Enterprises, and he as an editor. And he kept saying, "Hey, you should write something. You could probably get it published." And he kept at this for a couple years, and finally I said, okay, maybe I can do it.
Yeah, and we got, there are probably people today who don't know about Iron Crown, although they should. They should know about Iron Crown because it's one of the great RPG companies of the 80s, is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah.
They did Rollmaster, right?
Consult Limla's Subtable. Yes. I don't know. They had lots of charts.
Yeah, we always called it Chart Master, I'm sure. Yeah, Rollmaster. So was that what you did writing for? They did other things too, right?
I actually did Dark Space, and I did a bunch of creatures for one of their creature compendiums. So I had that publishing credit behind me, but what actually got me into actually leaving the biotech world is after I left college, I got a job working for a biopharmaceutical company in Boulder, Colorado. And I was a technician in charge of creating artificial strands of RNA, which we were using as drugs. And in order to create the machines, the synthesizers for this RNA and DNA, you needed these computers essentially. And that was the beginning of the internet in the early 90s. And on the beginning of the internet in the early 90s, they had all these things you could find called multi-user dungeons or multi-user shared hallucinations, which are basically text-based multi-user situations. And I went insane for this stuff, right? I would stay after work for hours. Yeah, and just MUD. I learned how to code mushes and MUDs. I learned C++ just so I could, like, you know, do this stuff, right? And I at one point, I was known as the king of database bloat for the Elendor, Middle Earth, Tolkien-based mush, because I was just so prolific. And that's actually, finally, TSR was looking for someone to do a D&D-based MUD, and they said, hey, who can do this? And I was like, I can do it! And they actually hired me to write the first D&D MUD, which, of course, as we all know, never happened. But that's how I left my job. And I went out to Wisconsin and started working at TSR in 1995.
Okay, well, that was my next question. How did you get from biotech to TSR? So you were active in fandom, basically, right? Doing all these MUDs and mushes. And so TSR was going to do a MUD. When was that? What year?
So they must have been looking for it. I don't know when they started, but they actually extended an offer to me in like August of 1995. And I was
going
to
guess 95. Okay.
I was out there. It was one of those things where I was like, you know, I had a job. I had gone to school, gotten a degree in a certain thing. And I was working in my field, you know, biotech. And then, you know, of course I was spending all my free time either playing D&D or doing MUDs and mushes. So obviously my passion was in the fantasy realm. And when I got the offer to come out and interview, of course I said yes. But then when I got the offer itself, it was a call which went to my answering machine. But I was listening to it. I sat up in bed straight. You know, it's like, oh, we'd like to offer you the job. It's a guy named David Wise who was working at the time.
I remember David Wise. Yeah. Yes.
And it was one of those things like, should I take this job? I mean, it was going to be for less money that I was making.
I was about to ask if they gave you a nice big fat pay raise to relocation fund, all that stuff. Yeah.
But I still had to know what it would be like to do it, right? So I accepted, and that's where I ended up. And I was like, all right, let's start working on these muds and mushes.
Yes.
And I don't know what happened exactly, but in my head, I always tell the story, and it's been many years now, that the president of the company at the time was like, I don't know. This is kind of the internet. Is it really going to take off? I don't know that that's true. This is what I tell myself, because they're like, it's not going to happen. We're not going to make the mud or mush. But this other guy just left the core D&D group. So if you want to take his office and you can start writing D&D, it's like, okay, I will do that then. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. I mean, before we leave the mud topic, like, did you had to have spent a bunch of time on the drive there or something thinking about how you would do a D&D mud? Like, is there something you can explain in just a couple minutes? I almost spent a lot of time on it, but like, what do you have an idea for that?
Well, muds and mushes had kind of an established sort of framework. Muds, especially, you could kind of start off you could just kind of take a template and then start elaborating on it. So I was thinking probably I would do something like that, but I was kind of just curious what they were thinking. Were they going to want to put me in a world, right? Was it going to be a brand new world? I mean, they kind of were always doing brand new worlds back then. Or would it be Forgotten Realms? Greyhound? You know, I didn't know for sure, but you know, yes, I was confident that I would be up to the job of whatever the situation was going to be thrown my way.
Well, fortunately, other opportunities came, because you missed your big D&D mud chance there.
I was a little sad about that for a while, but it was cool. It was super cool to be asked to start writing a D&D project right off the bat.
Now, Monty Cook was on our show a couple weeks ago. Now, Monty was there when you arrived, right? I mean, he had been there about
a year. And I imagine he said, hey, I know a guy who can write MUDs. I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah, he might have put in a good word for you.
Probably,
Yeah, I'm sure he claims he did, nothing else. And who's going to dispute it? I mean, I guess we could call David Wise, but I think David Wise would read the room and say, yeah, Monty, way to go.
I'm sure. I mean, he was the one who got me writing in the having any credit whatsoever in the role playing game industry by saying, write something, you can.
So, right. Okay, so you land at TSR, they give you an office, and they say, well, you're not doing MUDs, you're gonna work on D&D. So what did you work on? What was your first project you sat down? You know, on day two, after one day of doing MUDs or not doing MUDs.
So, the very first thing I did was very minor. I did some characters for a D&D comic book. But like day four, so I did like a dwarf and a dwarf cleric or something. I don't even remember now.
You mean you statted them out?
You didn't draw them, right?
It's a comic book. You didn't.
I said, here's what they look like, a dwarf. Yeah. But then day four, they said, hey, you know, we have this new system called Player's Option, where we have these rule books where we're going to give additional rules for players who want to get a little bit more in depth. And we need an adventure. And why don't you write that? It's going to be called Gates of Firestorm Peak. So they gave me the title and said, whatever you want to do, and use these optional rules that people can use to play this game of D&D. And I was like, okay, that's very exciting. I knew we were going to be maybe talking about this. I actually still have, I was in debate in high school, so I used a lot of illegal yellow notepads. So I actually still have, I don't know how well this will show up, my notes in two different notepads. I was very excited to write this.
Project, I could see a little mountain there. It looks like it's got a halo or something around it.
Yeah.
And lots of squiggles.
So there's lots of squiggles, lots of fire. So it's like, I have to plotted out the whole like situation of why it was called the Gates of Firestorm Peak. You know, every however many 27 years, these gates would open up when there would be this comet going through the sky. And I figured out it was this extra dimensional situation going on. And that became the Far Realm, which was introduced in the Gates of Firestorm Peak, because I was a fan of Lovecraft and all that kind of stuff, right? And that was a very exciting. And one of the things I was kind of concerned about, though, mechanically, was like, oh, they want use players' option rules, which are kind of a more finicky version of regular D&D rules. So what I actually did for every single encounter, I had a regular encounter and then just a bullet point or two saying player's option. So there'd be like one or two modifications for player's option, and that way everyone who played D&D could use the adventure, and everyone else who had player's option then could have these little modifications. I don't know anyone who's ever came up to me and said, hey, I used player's option to run that, right? So I think it turned out pretty well in that decision.
I got to admit, I don't remember the player's option series. Is that, maybe if I saw a book. It wasn't those leather-bound books, was it?
No. Is it okay for me to dash off camera a half second?
I'll keep everybody entertained. On. Yeah. Don't leave. Stay tuned. Bruce is getting a very important visual aid for us to illustrate his point here. Yep. And he's going to have to jack back into the motherboard here. So, yep.
All right, so
there he is. See, yeah, don't worry, you didn't miss a thing.
Players' options, spells, and magic. That wasn't quite out yet. The one that I wrote mine for was combat and tactics.
Okay, you know, I remember that now.
And
I do
skills
remember
skills and powers. Yeah, the skills and powers was the very first one, and so,
I mean, this is all second edition, right?
Yeah, it was like to make second edition a little more fancy.
I had I kind of gone down my own path. I'd started in first at AD&D. I only play the odd numbered editions of D&D. But by the time second edition came out, I had so many house rules for AD&D that really kind of fixed all the problems with AD&D anyway. That I was like, I don't need to bother. I can't go back at this point. So yeah. Okay. So that's cool.
Yeah, and then so while I was writing Gates of Firestorm Peak, at the time, the way that the schedules for writing the various projects were parceled out was very, I don't know, I guess they looked and see who had time in their schedule. And Bruce Hurd was in charge of that responsibility. And so
I remember Bruce.
I have to thank him because he saw that I had room in my schedule, and there was this big project coming up called Return to the Tomb of Horrors. Woo! And I was assigned to write it.
Yes.
At the time.
Glorious day.
Yes, it was a glorious day. But I have to tell you, at the time, I had not yet turned over Gates of Firestorm Peak. They didn't even know I was going to make my deadline. They didn't know what the quality of my writing was going to be like. I was the guy who was going to write the Mutter Mush.
Oh my gosh. So
I think it all turned out well.
That's good, because I was going to ask you, I knew that you had done Return to the Tomb of Horrors, and I was going to ask you, like, at the time that you got that, you had to have been really new to TSR, and yet this was a very high profile project. So I was thinking you must have really wowed everybody at TSR for them to put you up where, I mean, you'd think they'd give that to somebody like Skip Williams, you know?
I don't know what happened.
But it was just luck. It was just we have a hole in the schedule. We have the project. Oh, give it to the new guy. He'll do it. Yeah.
It's like the D&D gods kind of just reached down and said, bink. So.
Maybe Bruce had no idea how important it was. You know, who knows? Or I don't know.
I like to think he just saw something in me, a fresh-faced spark that was going to go on to, you know, do well. So thank you, Bruce.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can't imagine anybody out there watching this doesn't know, but Tomb of Horrors was a famous, famous module that I guess Gygax did it himself, maybe back in the late 70s, early 80s. And so you got to come back and do the return. So what? Okay, so we got to talk about this for a second. First of all, Tomb of Horrors is known for just being super deadly, right? I mean, it's got the Sphere of Annihilation, I think is one everybody remembers, and how many parties did the thief die trying to pick the trap or whatever and ends up getting sucked in. Did that stay? I mean, did you keep the Sphere of Annihilation?
So the way I
did spoiler alert, I guess.
All right.
Say. Yeah.
Yeah. So stop listening if you haven't played Return of the Tomb of Horrors yet. But the way I imagined it was 20 years after the original tomb had first come to the light in the world of this of your fantasy game, right? And right. People had gone in, and there'd been this huge kind of a compound that kind of built up around it of all these necromancers who were kind of trying to study a Sererac and figure out what's happening. Okay. So I left the original tomb, kind of, you could just still play through the original tomb because these necromancers kind of worshipped it in a way. And for some reason, it kept being reset. And of course, it all turned out that a Sererac was responsible for it all. And it was all a secret conduit which no one had quite figured out until the present, because that whole Sphere of Annihilation which you talk about was the key, that if you actually could figure out how to tune it correctly, it wasn't a Sphere of Annihilation, it was a portal to the next part of the entire situation, right? Which was these Orcuses. It was a demiplane that Orcus had created where he'd pulled an entire city out of the real world and into this demiplane. And
oh my God, you got all of that in Orcus too.
Yeah. And then, so that was the middle part. And then there was the Fortress of Conclusion, which was this basically this Sererac had built this nodule, which was on encrusting the negative material plane itself, right? I mean, it was just insane. It was an insane adventure, but it was fun to write.
But what did it say on the cover for adventurers level?
Nightmare of a Sererac's tomb once more hungers for life. That's what I'm reading.
Well, that's cool. So, I mean, it's a popular brand, but what's your perception of how well was it received? I mean, impression was really good, but I don't follow every single book that comes out.
It won an Origins Award, which was cool at the time. So that was cool. But yeah, people have since come up to me. I mean, people I know and respect who are actually in the game industry now, I guess, came in 10 years later. So I was like, oh yeah, I read Return of the Tomb of Horrors. That was really great. I'm like, really? Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for letting me know that. So yeah, no, I think people generally enjoyed it.
Oh, that's great.
Here's a really quick throwback though. So while I was writing it, right, it was one of those projects that was super big. It was a box set, had all these components, and I didn't have enough time in my regular schedule to write it. And so they actually also gave me a couple months worth of freelance during my regular job. So I was writing all the time, I guess.
Right.
But at one point, halfway through, maybe it was like 75% of the way through, there was a guy, I'm sure everyone knows Jim Ward, who was kind of in the hierarchy there. And he was very important. And so I gave him the project to read over. He's like, not deadly enough. All right, I guess I better amp it up more. And I don't know, I think that was a formative time for me, because in later years, I kind of became known as a person who writes too dangerous of adventures. So I thank Jim Ward for instilling that aesthetic in me.
Well, I think with Tomb of Horrors, you did have that. Jim was probably right. Don't tell him I said that about anything he said. But yeah, he was probably right. I mean, your Tomb of Horrors is just one of those games where everybody expects it to be crazy. No.
True enough.
Okay, so what'd you do after that? It's coming off of your glorious Tomb of Horrors.
Then it was just a lot of projects, right? It was like the Alithiad. It was the three Alithid modules that went with that. It was the Sea Devils modules, Reverse Dungeon.
I forgot that you did Sea Devils.
I didn't do the source book. That was done by Skip Williams, mm-hmm. but I did the three adventures associated with that, which was fun.
Right.
Gosh, just like lots of things. I guess I should drop a, I should look at my list of credits on my webpage.
No, oh no, that's okay. let's not. We'll
but
be here
right around day. That time. Things were kind of, you know, going. The company wasn't doing that well.
Well, let's, before we get into that, just one more question about the good times at TSR there. So who did you work with the most? I mean, who were the characters that you know, that you would like sit and, hey, let me run this by you. So,
sort of... You know, there was the entire crew. And Colin McComb was shared a wall with me, and we had a lot. They weren't open plan offices. They were kind of the cubicles, right? So they were like full up thing. But like, I could yell across the wall to Colin McComb. John Pickens was shared a corner wall with me. Most of the other people that I spent a lot of time hanging out with were like downstairs, Ray Valise, Michelle Carter, Monty, you know, Bill Slavicek was down there. Right. Just, you know, all Keith Strom, John Ratliff was my first editor.
Right.
Taught me a lot of things.
Good. Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, there's a special place in a writer's heart for a good editor.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And I had come off like the whole mush mud. I was really big into the Tolkien mush, right? So I was just my mind was filled with Tolkien facts, and John Ratliff being a Tolkien scholar, we hit it off really well as well, just for other reasons as well. For our mutual love of Tolkien.
right. Okay, so Then TSR ran into some difficult straits. There was about a year that you were working there where it was pretty tough, right?
Yeah, it was. There's one more person I want to mention, and I work with him again now this day, which is Sean Reynolds. It's kind of a funny story. When he first showed up, he shaved his head, right? But he was also wearing, I guess it turned out to be, they look like these kind of metal hand things, but I guess they turned out to be things for his when you work and you get, I don't know, I can't remember what you call it, but
carpal tunnel.
Yeah, that's what he had it. But I was like, who is this weird guy? He's kind of scary. Of course, turned out to be Sean Reynolds, but and we became friends back then. But anyway, yes. So no more stories of old TSR. Things are going poorly, and lo and behold, Wizards of the Coast. Who are these guys? Well, we know who you guys were because, of course, you know, Magic was big at the time. And yay, thank you, by the way. I don't know if I ever said that, but.
Well, it worked out really well for me too. So, you know, yeah, it certainly was, you know, one of the greatest privileges of my life to have had the opportunity to have gotten, you know, to have bought you guys, you know, moved you out to Seattle and all that stuff.
Yeah, because of the, I remember there was things, oh, it's going to be bought up, right? I had a couple resumes just sitting next to my door just to drop in the mail the moment, you know, I heard that I no longer had a job, blah, blah, blah. And then lo and behold, hey, Peter Atkinson's coming.
Yeah, so how'd you hear about it? Was there a big company announcement or somebody come and slip it to you?
That is a good question. I can't recall exactly how I found out. I think that it was just like said, yeah, there's going to be like interviews, right? We all kind of went in and we talked to, maybe it was you and like Linda Beardsley or something.
Yeah, well, the first round, I remember I came out, I think the first, I don't know if I would have called them interviews. It was more like, but I got together with the groups, like the, all the staff was organized into groups around what product lines they were working on at the time. So if you were probably core D&D, probably would have been with, I'm guessing, I remember being in all these meetings and I remember everybody, but I don't remember who was in what meeting.
Sure. No, it was like that. So many years ago. 1997, right?
Yeah, 1997. It was a lot of fun. It was so much fun. I was like a kid in a candy store, you know? I mean, I was in my 30s, you know? And it was like, you know, what a dream, what a fantasy to be able to, you know, run a company and go out and acquire the, you know, TSR, Dungeons and Dragons and Gen Con, of course, along with that.
You had us come out for like a week ahead of time to kind of try and find lodging and stuff like that. And I remember coming out there and So I had been in Colorado for like 10 years, right? And then I'd gone to Wisconsin for a few years. And I loved working at TSR, but the environment was kind of back reminding me of like where I grew up in South Dakota. It's not too far away, right? Which means really humid summers and insecty and very cold, snowy winters, right? And so when I went out to Seattle for that week, and there were just plants with fruit bearing, you know, blackberries and this cool and the trees and the pines and the mountains and the oceans. I'm like, oh my God, I am in love with this area. So that was for my first week. And then of course I moved out, but it was very magical.
Yeah. We call that recruiting weather. Yeah. I've made the mistakes before of recruiting people to Washington during the summer and from Southern California. They last 2 years, and then they move back because they go through that. They go through the Seattle winter. The first time they tell themselves it's an anomaly. The second time it kills them. And they're gone. But the people from Wisconsin are a hardier lot. You know, they're like, oh, we don't care about this
a little rain.
7-8 months of gloom and rain. Okay, look at how beautiful it is in the summer. It's all good. Yes. Although I say that, but you know, a lot of the people you worked with have moved back, you know.
That's true.
You know, it's, I don't know what the ratio is. It's probably about 50-50 in terms of how many people stayed out here and people to move back, if not to Wisconsin, to somewhere else, you know. So you accepted the offer. Thank you, by the way, because I know that you did some more great stories to come of your time at Wizards of the Coast. So you came out to Wizards. What did you get assigned to then? Did the organization? I mean, I think the group of writers stayed more or less intact because the TSR writing team was. Some, you know, we wanted to keep that group together, but like the, you know, a lot of the artists went off and worked in the art department, and you know, tech guy, you know, Sean Reynolds, for example, went and worked on the web team, and so there was some forced integration, but you I think you ended up with most of the other writers in the TSR R&D group, if you will.
Yep. I finished up a couple of the kind of lingering second edition stuff that was going on. One of which, the very last one I worked on, was called Die Vecna Die. And we actually had the idea.
Worked on all the best stuff, Bruce. And my favorite's still to come. But Die Vecna Die.
Well, I was brought in, they're like, oh, the writers don't have enough time to finish this. So would you come in? And I was like, yes, I will do that. And it was great because it was kind of pitched to me as like what we'd really, and it was pitched like by Ryan Dancy. I think one of you told me, won't this be a great way to end your second edition campaign, right? So what crazy things can happen that will end your second edition campaign? And so that's why. We strolled through the various realms of second edition from Greyhawk to Ravenloft to finally Sigil, the Planescape realm, right? And
right.
Vecna starred to some extent. And so that was the final thing I worked on for second edition. And then during that period of time, you started the core design team, and including yourself, to work on third edition.
Third edition, that's right.
So,
yeah, that decision to do a third edition took me about 2 seconds.
Yeah, well, obviously it turned out to be the super smart, right? I mean, that saved the brand.
It was it was. I mean, what would you do if you bought D&D right now, right? You'd do sixth edition. Maybe not, because fifth edition's pretty dang good, but it's got a lot of traction, so I don't know. It'd probably be a big error for them to do a sixth edition so soon. But
probably. I worked on fifth edition, by the way.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I worked on it for a few years. Okay, before.
But you're. But
so anyway,
as a freelancer, you were. I mean,
no, I was still there up until 2013, and so 2012, 20. I mean, for several years, we were working on fifth edition before I finally left. I mean. And I have credit in the books, in the fifth edition books.
Wow, so that's great.
I've worked on second, third, 3.5, fourth, and fifth edition. So I've been part of the thing for a while.
You've been part of the Indian for a long time. You worked at Wizards longer than I did.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, if you consider TSR part of Wizards.
No, even Wizards. I was only there 10 years.
Oh, really?
I started the company in 1990 and sold it in 2000.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy to think about.
Yeah, I stayed another year after that. So I was there 11 years. But you were there, sounds like, 15 or 16 years. So
probably 15. If you don't count TSR, then like 18-ish, right around 18, almost 18, you count TSR.
Right. Okay, so you did Die Vecna Die. That was did you work with anybody on that? Or
Steve Miller had a chunk of the Ravenloft stuff, right? So that's why I kind of integrated what he had written for the Ravenloft with the initial Greyhawk stuff and the final Planescape stuff. And I think it was Ryan Dancy who pitched the project to me. He said, it'd be really cool if, I think he said it'd be cool if they started off with Greyhawk, went to Ravenloft, and, ended up in Planescape. And I was like, that's what I'll do. So I had to credit him for saying that's the overall, direction.
Yeah. It sounds like a Ryan Dancy idea. Like it does sound like a Ryan Dancy. We can give Ryan one credit every three episodes.
Okay.
That's the limit. So there we go. That means Harold Johnson can't say anything nice.
All right. Fair enough.
We have a Ryan limit. So okay, that's weird. So did you go from that to third edition? What did you work on?
We all kind of were, to the extent we could, we tried to help out the core design team. But what I was then put on was be like, Bruce, you write a lot of adventures. Why don't you write the first third edition adventure, right? Which meant staying on top of what the rules were going to be and what things were happening, and also trying to get a sense of like, what would make a great first experience for people just starting out in D&D? Because hopefully third edition will capture a lot of people or bring a lot of people back into the fold as well. And so what I tried to do is just think about all the wonderful experiences in playing adventures that I had growing up, all the bits and pieces and elements. And of course, I talked to all the designers. I talked to all, not just the core designers, but everyone, right, to try and come up with a great thing. And I was actually on a car ride with my ex-wife at the time, Dee Westman, who had run Gen Con at TSR, right? So anyway, and I came up with the idea, the Sunless Citadel. It'll be this thing that used to be this place that fell beneath the earth. And of course, it's been all these great goblins and, kobolds will have infested it, but there's going to be this dark druid under there, and it'll be the start of this whole big, long campaign path, right? That I did end up writing the middle and last one eventually, but the Sunless Citadel was the first. And by pure accident, I did go into it trying to do a lot of different things, traps, RPGs, encounters and fights, of course, and fun, cool lore that people could think about. And Meepo was this kobold that I had people it was just this weird little thing where I was like, oh, there's this kobold and he lost the little dragon wormling. Wormlings also being new to third edition, right? That was a kind of thing that I could use. And they had lost their tribal mascot, and Meepo was the wormling keeper. And he was crying when the PCs first meet the little guy. And apparently that really stuck with players from all across. So many people played Sunless Citadel, it'd be in the first adventure. I have every convention I go to, someone will come up to me and go, Meepo!
Meepo!
So that was fun. That was my first third edition project.
Right. So what was it like interfacing with the third edition design team? Skip and Rich and
Jonathan
and Monty.
It was good. It was fine. I would send things to them, and usually be like, yay. One time though, when I was writing, Sun of Citadel, and I had this idea for this dark druid, right? And I think not too long before that, the Blair Witch Project had come out. And this hadn't ever actually happened in Blair Witch, but I imagined what if those little twig things you saw, kind of like these little witch sigils sitting in the corners, kind of got up and started moving around, right? Came after you. It was like, oh, twig whites was my idea for these creatures. I was like, all right, twig whites, that'll be great. And Jonathan Tweet came to my desk and said, you know, third edition is going to be new to a lot of people, and we have the concept of whites. And whites are human, are undead. And these twig whites are not undead. And I think it'll be really confusing to people. So I really would rather you don't have twig whites in this adventure. I'm like, oh, okay. So I sat there for a second and I said, how about twig blights? Blights being something that are more plant-like. It's a better name, you know.
Right.
Still an adventure, better name. Right. I'm like, thanks, Jonathan. You improved that by asking me not to put it in there. So, so yeah. I think of all the third edition core designers, Jonathan is the one I had the most interaction with, because I was also working, I don't know how much longer after that, I was working on the Psionics rules for third edition.
I just want to say, so Derek, our producer, is on the chat, and he said he had a lot of fun with Meeple. And see, there you go. Somebody's popping in right now and saying, yeah, Meepo.
Yay. Still. That was 2000, right? Right-ish? Right around there? 2001?
I don't know. I mean, third edition came out in 2000. So that sounds about right. Or 99. Was it 99? Oh, jeez. Yeah, I think for a long time I thought it was 99, and somebody said no, it was 2000, and I was really disappointed. But it makes more sense that it might have taken us 3 years instead of two to get it out. And, yeah. So yes, I meant Monty Cook, or somebody going by the name Monty Cook saying 2000. So
oh, you know, that might be Monty, since there's Monty Cook Games and Monty Cook. So that
Monty Cook Games. Yeah, there we go. Hey, Monty Cook, or derivations of the word Monty Cook, are making up half of our audience here. All right.
Well, I better not say anything bad like I was planning about, you know. No.
Oh, okay. So I mentioned earlier, we haven't even gotten to my favorite thing that you worked on, but you just mentioned it, the Psionics.
Oh, right.
Third edition. Yes. This is actually this is one of my favorite moments of you and me. Is that I love Psionics. I always thought Psionics was a great part of D&D. Of course, back in AD&D, every time everybody rolled up a character, okay, I rolled a percentile dice, see if you have Psionics. Every once in a while, not very often, every once in a while, somebody would roll it. Oh, you got Psionics. And there's a moment of rejoicing. And
yes.
You know, and then the character dies, you know, or whatever. But so you were always a fan of Psionics too, if I... Yeah,
I was. It was just one of those things, right? I had many characters growing up that had psionics, or I would let players have psionics of their own. And for whatever reason, I guess, because I wrote the Alithiad at TSR, and those creatures had psionics, and I had I'd come up with a rule modification or two to make psionics work a little easier, I thought, for my purposes. In the Alithiad, and also the three adventures that went after that. And so I guess someone, whoever was, maybe it was Bill, had remembered that, and they said, hey, Bruce, you do psionics. You want to do the psionics handbook? I'm like, yes, I do want to do the psionics handbook. I love psionics. So that's how that happened. And I was going to say, you know, I was kind of going back and forth with Jonathan about various rules. And I was like, well, it should work this way, and it should be PowerPoints, blah, blah, blah. And I don't even remember now what it was. He said, I don't know about this rule, blah, blah, blah. And I go, but the kids love it. And I don't know why I said that. And I don't know in what sense, but he just goes, all right, yeah, whatever. Do it that way then.
You said the kids loved it, but you...
I said the kids love it.
You were just making it up.
I mean, I was just making it up because there was no data. I was arguing facetiously.
Yeah, that's funny.
But then we came out. we came out with the Psionics Handbook, and you know, it turns out there were probably some issues with it. But hey, then we came out with the expanded Psionics Handbook, and all was.
Did you write that too?
I was the lead designer on that, and we had a couple other people working with me on it. I wrote the vast bulk of it, but this was when we first started to put in developers, and I really credit the work of the developers on that to improve that book. And God, am I going to be able to come up with their names? I think Andrew Fitch was one, and Dene was the other. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, those guys did a great job helping. So, and we came out with a great book.
Well, Andrew's a really sharp guy. I didn't know Mike that well, but I gamed a lot with Andrew Fitch, and he was one of the few people that was at Wizards before and did an interface a lot after with the TSR, with the TSR crowd. So
that was definitely
good. Yeah. Well, good job on Psionics. I used the Psionics Handbook quite a bit during my third edition days there. So
nice.
Yeah, good job.
Psionics really was something that divided the external fan community, a lot. There was only there was a smaller percentage of people who would use Psionics, and those people didn't have a problem with saying what they thought in no uncertain terms on the electronic boards. And that was kind of a wake up call for me to kind of early, oh my gosh, people are saying bad things about me online.
Oh my God, Bruce, you've figured that out now, right?
This was my first experience with that.
I was devastated. My first experience with people talking, saying, with the internet haters was during the Magic the Gathering heyday, early in 1990, mainly 1994. I was like, before Magic, when we were doing Primal Order and Talislana, small little company doing products nobody's ever heard of now. Everybody loved us, because it was just a handful of fans, and we were the niche-y, cool stuff, and then we came out with Magic the Gathering, and I just thought, oh, people are going to really love us now.
A wider circle around yourself.
Yeah. I had no idea what I was in for. I was very depressing. I mean, it was really, it took me, and then eventually I just figured out, oh, screw it. Don't listen to the haters. It's just the 99% of the people who aren't out there saying all this crap, they're just fine with it. They're okay. They're having a good. You go to conventions where you get the love. You don't get the love on the online, right? You go on the internet, you get the hate. But at conventions,
you get the love.
Hopefully, conventions will be back again here. there you get the love. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, one thing I just got. I mean, you've so many really amazing products you got to work on, that you got to work on. And must be pretty proud.
I guess yes. Each when you're it's a full time job, though it's been a full time job for me for years now. Our rule is to say if you're gonna say a decade, don't say that. Say for a while now. Sounds better. So I've been full time writer of RPGs for a while now, and I mean I am happy sometimes something comes along and a lot of other people put a lot of work into it, both editing, art, layout, design, graphic design, and I do get a book like that, I'm like, I want to lick this book, right? I want to do something with it, but I'm already working on the next project, so I can't spend too much time thinking about the last one. Sometimes
it strikes me that by the time you're done writing it, you're happy to just throw it over the fence. And I mean, at some point you're tired of it, no matter how great it is, right? I mean, you got to get your head into the next thing and move on, right?
Yep. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Well, we only have about 10 minutes left, so we got to cover the next 15 years here.
Okay. Well,
I'll tell you what, I'll make it easy. We can just skip fourth edition. We can just skip fourth edition and go right to fifth edition. Is there a Psionics book for fifth edition? I haven't even looked.
No, there's not. I mean, I'm not plugged into that anymore. I was working on fifth edition for a couple years, and I've kind of kept in contact with those guys to some extent. In fact, I just talked to Chris Perkins not too long ago. But I don't think there is.
Yeah.
I mean, they could say, no, we're working on this and you haven't heard anything about it, but I don't think so.
Yeah. So what are you doing? Okay. So you were at Wizards to 2013. You worked on all the way up through. Well, what did you do on fifth edition while you were there?
I wrote so many different versions of all the different character classes. I wrote sections of the Dungeon Master's Guide on the magic items, right? I worked on every different aspect of it, but one of the things we were doing is just doing iteration after iteration after iteration. So, there are sections of text in the current books that are mine, but there's also lots of stuff, because after I left, they worked on it for a full another year, the core design team.
By the way, Derek's on chat. He says 5th edition has some psionic stuff in Unearthed Arcana.
Oh, thanks, Derek.
Interesting. I'll have to check it out. Right. I just started playing 5th edition pretty recently. Well, I mean, I guess it's been at least a year, but, the rate that we play games these days is different than it was when we were in college.
We don't play every single day at lunch, right?
Yeah. I mean, The PC group I've been DMing the most just got to 6th level. So, we're still a long ways from really knowing everything that's in 5th edition. So,
It turns out I've been, through my current company, MCG, we've been working on 5th edition again, or at least 5e related material.
Are you working on the 5th edition Tolas?
So this thing, I don't think it's been released. Uh-oh. But I think it's going to, we have the pre-press copies of Arcana of the Ancients. So that's a 5e compatible book has an adventure, several adventures, and it has creatures and ciphers and devices and science fantasy smorgasbord for your 5th edition game. So it's kind of been weird now to get back into 5th edition after kind of leaving it behind since 2013.
So did you write this book? Is that why you're so proud of it?
I wrote... Part of it. I wrote half of it.
Wow, that counts.
Monty, myself, and Sean Reynolds are the authors on this one.
All right.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just thinking. Oh, like, yeah, fifth edition. Oh, wait, that reminds me.
That's great.
I have it sitting right here.
Yeah. No. Good. Yeah. That's fantastic. So you've been. Did you go directly from Wizards to working for? You've been working for Monty since 2013.
So the way that happened was. Well, I was still back in the early 2000s after third edition. Wizards had a book department, right? And they had a very successful Forgotten Realms and all this stuff, right? And I had always wanted to write novels. And so I would go and say, I can write a novel. Let me try and write a novel, blah, blah, blah. And they finally let me. And they were happy with my first novel, which was under a house name, T.H. Lane, The Oath of Nerul. So then I got to use my own name and... They put me into Forgotten Realms, and I wrote, all said and done, eight Forgotten Realms novels and that other Oath of Nerul. So 9 novels for the TSR department. And I really loved it, right? Because it was something I could kind of do on my side. It was my own baby. Even if I was writing in a shared world, it was still my characters, my story, my plot. And right around towards the end of, 2010, 2011, 2012, the whole... TSR lost its book publication department. And books were going through that whole time where like, oh, it's all eBooks and blah, blah, blah. And they were falling off a cliff. And I really wanted to write another novel. So I essentially said in my head, I wanted to write a novel, and fifth edition was going along well. And I was like, well, I'm going to write a science fiction novel. That's something I've never done. And TSR won't care if I write a science fiction novel. And ultimately I was like, I'm going to leave Wizards and write a science fiction novel. It's going to be great. But I told a person whose name has come up a few times, my friend Monty, the story of what the novel was going to be about. And he said, hey, we could write a game based on this. And that's why they hired me just a few weeks later to come on board. And we started working on The Strange, which became a game line at MCT. So that's how I made the transition over to to Monika Games.
Another just great opportunity, kind of random in a way. You're really charmed. You're not just charming. You are charmed.
Oh my gosh! Turning my head. I guess so. In a way, now that you say it that way, yeah. No, I've had a lot of good things come my way in my life, and I'm very grateful.
That's fabulous. So, are you working on the new big Tolus 5th edition release?
That Kickstarter ended here a few weeks ago.
Yep,
it's going to open up on BackerKit, but we're not going to begin design on that for at least main design for probably a few weeks, not a little bit longer. But yes, we're already figuring out who amongst the design team will be working on what. And it's very exciting. It was very exciting to kind of reach back, you know, because Tolus before Tolus, there was Praemol, which was a kind of a proto third edition campaign. And then when Tolus came out, that was a very third edition campaign. And I had four different characters throughout the course of Tolus. So it's kind of fun to like think back about all those great times, all those great adventures.
Right, right. Hey, we're getting close to the end. I just shout out to chat. Thanks for all the running dialogue. If anybody has any questions for Bruce, feel free to get him in quickly.
This one about quickly. Wow.
I have sort of a touchy-feely question to ask you. Like thinking back about on your time, all the time working at Wizards, the third edition era, the acquisition, you know, I mean, it was really heady days. What do you take with you from that? Like, when you look back on that, your whole career working with D&D and Monty Cook,
I guess what I would take from it is just all the great people that I've met and worked with and learned from, right? All the interactions I had over the years and the friendships that I've built and maintained, right? And, even to this moment, right? This opportunity to hang out and talk with you, right? And it's because of all that. So yeah, that's just, I guess, the friendships.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think those friendships, and I gotta say, it was so much fun when the TSR gang moved out to Seattle, you know, because it was a shock for you, but it was a shock for us too. I mean, but everybody wanted to make it work, you know.
You guys bent over backwards, right? I mean, we got this huge new building, and we were an old QTEP factory in Lake Geneva. So the building was just like fresh and new, and everything was nice, and we got 401ks, and you know.
I think there was a lot in both groups. There was a lot of pride of suddenly being allied with the other group, right? You know, people are like, all the magic. Everybody worked on magic. Fans of D&D, right? And I think some people that worked on D&D were fans of magic. I know Jim Ward was a big fan. But hey, we got a couple questions in chat. Let's see. We have Garth Mindfeather. I have a question for you. That's a great name. I missed the beginning of the story. Retreads things already talked about. How did you get into the Lovecraft mythos, Bruce? And which seemed to have inspired your work?
Yeah. So yeah, the Far Realm was very Lovecraft inspired, right? Which was in the Gates of Firestorm Peak. I guess I just read a lot. My group of friends, one of the things we read and probably talked about was a lot of Lovecraft. I have all the old Lovecraft novels, which were had this creepy art on it by too many names. I'm trying to reach back. He was a very famous fantasy author, artist back in the 80s. Michael Whelan did some Lovecraft covers, and they were just super good, you know, and
right.
So did a bunch of Elric and stuff like that, of course. But you know, it was just kind of part of the mindset in the 80s.
You were a fan of it.
I just read it all and just loved the creepiness of it.
Right, right. And then Fexter, right, Bruce.
Sorry, hold on. I thought
You got to go.
That was my dog's pain pill. Okay. I thought I turned off my.
We're almost up. We're almost done. Let me do this one question. And okay, so Fexter asked Bruce, when will there be a Strange campaign mastered by you?
Oh well, the Strange is the game system we were talking about when I'm not sure what that question means exactly, but I have run many games of the Strange.
I think Fexter wants you to get online now and run a game.
Run a game for him? All right. Give me five and I will put something together.
Yeah. All right. okay. Well, our time is up. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really fun to have you on the show.
Thank you so much as well. It's been super fun to talk about all this stuff and kind of reach back and hang out and remember it all.
I hope you enjoyed today's new episode of Fireside with Peter Adkisson. If you want to catch the show live, be sure to tune in every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific on twitch.tv/GenConTV. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to stay up to date on all the Fireside podcast happenings. We will be back every Monday with a classic episode of Fireside covering the history of Magic the Gathering, and every Friday with a new episode of Fireside Dungeons & Dragons. Again, I've been Marcus from GenConTV. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you soon.